Hello and welcome to the Barwick World Show, the longest running web design podcast where we're looking at user experience design, conversion rate optimization and working in the web. In this week's show, we're going to discuss the state of UX today, what the future holds and how UX needs to position itself going forward. My name is Paul Boag and joining me this week is Marcus Lillington and Jared Spool. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing, guys? I'm enjoying this. Can I just say, a bit cheekily, I'm enjoying the fact that I'm the youngest person in a room for once.
So that's pretty rare, really, Paul, surely.
It's very rare these days.
Yeah, I go so many places and I'm like, holy shit, I'm the oldest one here.
I know. You look around and these days and you go, blimmin' heck, there are all these young upstarts make us all look old and decrepit and ancient and out of date. But that's okay. I'm all right with that. There's some pretty cool people around these days. So what's the plan with you, Jared? We often talk about on this show now, because we've reached that age, about retirement and that kind of thing. Is that something you're going to do, or are you one of these people that are going to work into your grave?
My current plan is to retire about 3 years after I pass away.
Brilliant.
I figure that's about the right amount of time to finish all the projects I've started.
Yeah, I know that feeling. But also, I think it's quite an exciting time at the moment. I mean, there's always something new coming along. That's my problem, is that there's always new shine. Marcus, on the other hand, is ready to go and retire and sit in a garden somewhere, aren't you? Work in a garden centre, that's what you wanted to do.
Or something like that, yeah. Grow plants, that would be lovely. My feeling at the moment is, yes, because of things like AI and the things we'll probably be discussing today, I have this feeling of like, phew, I don't really have to worry about it too much because I'm going to be gone soon. Well, soon, maybe not that soon, but, you know, it's I'm not 20 years old anymore. It's not something that I need to have to kind of like really focus on. I'm just kind of carrying on running the business, and these younger people that I work with can look after all that kind of thing.
See, it's as long as there's something new and shiny coming up, I'm still interested. You know, it's always the latest thing coming along that inspires me. So, Jared, what are all these projects you've got going on? What's happening in your world?
Well, most of the projects that I have are around focusing on how to guide UX professionals to really contribute to their fullest in their organizations. I feel like far too many UX folks, and not to say that they've somehow made a mistake, but there is just so much more that UX and these people can bring to their organizations that in so many cases are not being brought. And a lot of it is because nobody around them does it. So they don't either realize it's doable or don't know how to do it or something. But once you sort of open up the world and say, look, there's this whole other way to think about your work, and you can and if you do that, you can start really bringing value into your organization. Everything changes.
No, because I mean, I've been watching one of two of your leaders of awesomeness, which I have to call you out on. Terrible name, Jared. What were you thinking? Yeah, leaders of awesomeness.
Now, terrible names is sort of our corporate brand.
So. Oh, I see. Oh, fair enough.
Well, that's like flowery okay. Shirts or something like that.
Yeah.
We
so
we're there.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched a few of them back, and then I've attended one live, and they're really, really good stuff that you're sharing pretty much every week, isn't it? You do one of those sessions.
Yeah. Which we is do brilliant. We do something every week. Been doing it was started during the pandemic. It was sort of a okay, what the hell do we do now? Because the entire business model was based on getting people into rooms. And when we couldn't get people into rooms anymore, we're like, okay, what do we do? And
yeah.
So my co-founder and business partner, Leslie Jensen Inman, had this brilliant idea. Why don't we just host, you know, a weekly, talk? And I'm like, I'm going to write a talk every week. And she's like, yeah, why not? And I'm like, okay. And that's what I've been doing. We have done 212 of them since June of 2020.
And like Charlie Parker, you've never repeated a phrase. Is that right?
So. Yeah. There's the old jazz joke about, you know, this next song has the same notes as the last song, just in a different order. almost all of it is focused on strategic UX and making the transition from tactical user experience work to strategic user experience work. So we work within constraints. Have to come up with a new topic every week that talks about something to do with moving from tactical to strategic.
They're just great, enjoyable sessions as well, and very real and kind of practical. I'll put a link in the show notes to them if you want to check them out. And there's a nice little
free
community.
Point out, they're free. We'd love to.
We didn't say that bit, did we?
This is not. We do things for money, but this is not one of them.
And obviously, there's a whole suite of different workshops and stuff that Jared and his team run, which are definitely worth checking out. But these Leaderships of Awesomeness are a kind of nice chance to find other people in a similar situation to you. If you're working in UX, maybe finding it a little bit frustrating. It's very therapeutic as a group, I found it. So enjoyable.
Good. Yeah, I mean, that was a goal. You know, during the
pandemic, we all needed that in COVID. Yeah.
The goal was just to have something that was not talking about, the pandemic. And then when, in 2023 or so, when things started to flip in the job market, we started to focus on, we spend some amount of time on what it means to look for work in this market now that it's inverted. But we also spend time talking about how to really change your career, how to change the vector of your career so that you're not stuck at the in what we call the IC compression that happens at the top of the pay scale.
I want to get into some of that stuff in a minute, but before we do that, I just we normally do a kind of app of the week type scenario where we just share some of the cool stuff that's going on. And in this week, see, this is going to be a little while before this one comes out, but in the past week, we've just had Figma's conference again this year, and they are so blatantly going, we're launching loads of stuff because we're about to go to IPO and we want to look impressive. So they've kind of released this whole suite of dubious apps, one of which is one called Figma Sites. And the idea is that they're going up against Framer and Webflow and various other people to allow you to publish websites directly from Figma. And I am very cynical about stuff like this. You definitely shouldn't be using this to release anything other than the smallest kind of mum and pop website. The code is terrible. It's completely inaccessible. But it's actually not even a lot of good from a prototyping point of view, which was what I was hoping, because you can't, it doesn't allow any data entry at all. You can't put a contact us form or anything like that in this thing. And you think, blood my neck, if you can't even do data entry, that's like 80% of the web, isn't it? I'm not overly impressed with Figma at the moment. No doubt it will improve, but the reason I bring this up is not just to badmouth Figma, but there is an alternative, because they're also going to release something called Figma Make. So there's Figma Site and then there's Figma Make. And Figma Make is one of these vibe coding tools that have coming out. And that isn't... Oh, I hate the term vibe coding. I hate it. But it's stuck now. What do you do? Assisted coding. That's what we should call it.
Yes.
So anyway...
Bad coding, I think, is what we should call it. Bad
coding. Yeah, that too. Yeah, that works. But it's quite useful for prototyping, because this is the big thing that I get stuck on, Jared, is you visualize something in Figma. You want to prototype it so that you can test it. But the problem that you have is that Figma's prototyping sucks. Because yeah, it can do lots of fancy animations and stuff, but it, like I say, it can't do data entry, which always strikes me as ridiculous. But there's this tool called Ready, R-E-D, so readdy.ai. And I really quite impressive. You tried it, Jared?
I just Googled, because the first thing that came to mind when I thought of Figma sites was Dreamweaver. But then and you know, this is only a conversation you can have with three old people. But then I immediately thought of Microsoft Pages, and I'm like, whatever happened to Microsoft Pages? They still sell Microsoft Pages. It's now billed as quality enterprise grade AI driven business portals.
What is a business portal, I wonder?
A business portal is a web page that executives don't understand.
Right.
Okay. There you go. That's the official definition.
A portal.
So
I remember but portals. I've got,
yeah, portals, they were. Right? That was, yeah, right? That was a big thing.
Figma portals is the next thing that's coming.
Oh, no. It will be. So anyway, this Ready... app is quite good, actually. So you go in, it's like assisted coding but for designers. So you can basically describe your user interface, right? So you can go create me a menu, have these elements in, have the logo on the left, so, you know, but it's creating it out of real HTML and CSS, which means it's responsive by default. It's got data entry in. So it's a really good tool for like UI designers to do some kind of co-pilot type generation of user interfaces in. So it doesn't magically go away and do it without you. You know, we're not at that kind of point, but we are at a situation where you can sit down with an AI, just talk through what you want, and it starts assembling stuff on the screen for you, and you can select any element out of it and go, no, that wasn't quite what I had in mind, do this instead. And you end up with an interactive prototype that you can test in the real world, which I really liked. It felt like a nice way of approaching it, and I had a good play with it. And it's one of those weird things. I don't know whether you feel like this whenever you use dictation. So when you're typing on a keyboard, you feel like you're going really fast, don't you? Type, 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 achieving a lot. And when you dictate, you're going, and you're thinking about what to say next, and you end up feeling like it's going slower, but actually it's going faster than you can type. It felt like this using this, right? So I actually did a side-by-side comparison. I built it in Figma and then I built it in Ready, and it was quicker in Ready, but it felt slower because I was having to think with the AI and wait around for the AI. But actually it came together much, much quicker. So there's a productivity gain here as well. But just to be clear, this isn't replacing UI designers. It's not Jacob Nielsen's comments about AI designing all user interfaces in 5 years. Have you heard that one, Jared?
I heard him say it and wondered why he likes to punish himself.
Exactly. I mean, he also said that all the important UX battles have been won.
Yeah, I mean, of course they have. and
he's gone deep into the AI.
Yes, he has. He has, and I keep meaning to send him a message that just says, you know, you do realize that Kool-Aid was just the flavoring. There's too many people who've gone a little too deep into the AI. I am not there. To me, I think it's a scam.
I don't feel that. I don't think I sit somewhere in between. I can see it as a productivity tool, which will enable me to create interfaces faster, to research better. I'm finding it a very useful tool for analyzing data sets, that kind of thing. I don't think it's about to replace anybody. We haven't seen that with any other technical innovation over the last however many years. It comes along, everybody goes, oh, we're not going to need X now, but it just means that that person can do more with less.
I sat on an airplane a few years ago next to a blacksmith.
Right, yeah.
Now, what I learned was they don't use a lot of metals anymore. You don't put metal horseshoes on a horse. It's actually considered to be cruel and medically unsound. You don't take an expensive horse and put a metal horseshoe on it, apparently. Everything's plastics. And so their job is to fit the feet with, you know, or hoofs, I guess. Do horses have feet? They have hoofs. To fit the hoofs with plastic. So the entire profession has shifted under the technology, and you don't need as many blacksmiths as you used to. Not so much because a single blacksmith can do more with less, though there is something to that apparently, but mostly because most people don't have a horse anymore. So, but you know, if blacksmiths still exist, I'm thinking, you know, the rest of the world is not going anywhere very fast.
Exactly. Just to go back to that, the Jacob Nielsen thing about all the UX battles having been won implies to me that all of our clients, the people I deal with, all understand all of the UX-related issues with building websites and interfaces and all this kind of thing, but they don't. They still are interested in impressing their internal audiences, their bosses. They're impressed by WYSI stuff. They're not impressed by accessibility. Nothing's changed, really. And we still need to educate.
I think what he was driving at, to be fair to him, is that...
Why should we be fair to him?
Okay, let's...
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no, I just think what he was driving at was that there are solutions out there to a lot of the UI problems that we encounter, whether or not people are using those solutions or whether they're favoring them, they are there, which I guess is true to a degree, although I think now, as we get a new technology like AI, we now have a whole new set of UX problems that I think that presents. So, you know, I can see it from one side, but not from another. And I think it very much, he needs to be more specific about what it is that he's saying through that. But, you know.
Well, I mean, to me, this generative AI piece, right? And you have to separate out generative AI from other types of machine learning and AI, because it's really, even though it's what everybody thinks of as AI these days, it is just a small piece of the field. But generative AI, this idea that you sit in a text box, in a message box, a chat window, and you describe what you want in words, And the system then tries to interpret what you want in words. I think it is a step backwards. I mean, we've basically we've reinvented the command line.
That's got to be the name of the show, by the way.
Reinvented the command line, yeah.
Right? I mean,
I know what you mean.
Describing a UI in a paragraph is like trying to describe architecture with interpretive dance. There's, it is just a wacky way to do work. And I think people like it because it creates this exclusionary superpower, right? I think one of the things that people are really excited about is, whereas, you know, maybe 2 years ago, it was hard to make a statement that you were somehow a better designer than the person in the cube next to you, because the type of things you were doing and the type of things they were doing, especially if there was a pre-existing design system and, you know, existing design patterns and user flows, everybody was basically producing the same quality work for the same type of problems. And now you have a differentiator. Either you are a master of prompts or you are clueless at prompts. And suddenly you have a skill set that the people in the cube next to you don't have. And I think that's possibly one of the drivers of this, is that it's obfuscated enough. It reminds me, I don't know if you all remember this thing that existed in the late 80s, early 90s called Kai's Power Tools.
Yeah.
So this was a visual design tool that could take Photoshop files and do really impressive things with them. You know, basically it added a layer of features to Photoshop that Adobe hadn't built in yet. And it was completely obsoleted when Adobe eventually came along and just built all the features that Kai Power Tools had. But it would do fancy types of drop shadows that would make things look all shiny and metallic. And it had tools for doing all sorts of fancy gradients, things that were hard to do in Photoshop or Illustrator at the time, or freehand or whatever you were using. But the UI was completely inscrutable for this tool. In fact, there was a version of it at one point where 2/3 of the UI came locked out from the user. And the only way you could get access to those 2/3 of the features was you had to demonstrate to the program that you had mastered the other third of the features. And then it would unlock, you'd get unlock codes, and it would unlock these more advanced features because you'd earned them. It was like a game. And people love this because people could say, I have unlocked all the features, which meant you were better at the tool than the person who was charging half your rate and couldn't use the tool. And I think that's some of the world we're back into here.
I think you'll be deeply cynical, but I do think there is a grain of truth in it. I think the other thing with it, to my mind, it's like it's going through the same cycle that any new piece of technology goes through. To begin with, we're just impressed that the bloody thing works, right? And it can do anything.
I used to call the talking horse. It doesn't matter what the horse says, the fact that it can talk at all is the impressive part.
So we've done that stage. We're now into the let's pile in as many features and functionality as we can, the kind of VHS stage. But then the inevitable next stage is that people will start caring about how easy it is to use. And we're even beginning to see elements of that with tools like Ready, where they're thinking, well, hang on a minute, you know, having to describe the element you want to change is cumbersome. Why don't we just let people click on the element? And then, you know, so we're beginning to see the them move into the kind of user experience, user interface elements of it. So I've got a feeling that it's just as much the inevitable evolution of the technology as anything else. I've got to say I'm a bit more excited perhaps than Jared is, and maybe I'm just more excited about it because I like new and shiny, and I like being that, you know, the person that's able to say, oh, I like AI and I'm on top of AI. Perhaps I'm falling for your very trap.
Here's the thing. I'm seeing a lot of people take tools like this Ready, Ready, Ready thing. And they play with it and they come up with a toy outcome and they're like, oh, that was really cool. And I think a lot of AI does that really well. It's impressive because you can do things faster and more efficiently and in this different mode than with the existing tools, the sort of non-AI suites. But what I'm not seeing people successfully do, and I've seen people try, but they haven't been successful, is actually use it in a production environment. And here's the thing with prototyping. Right? How does this tool, and I haven't played with it, I don't know anything about it, you know, this is the first I'm hearing of it. But how does this tool work when I have to prototype something where two-thirds of the design already exists? I just need to prototype the other third. And as I conduct my usability tests and I want to use some sort of, you know, write like usability testing method where I'm quickly iterating, I have 20 minutes to go back between sessions and make a change and produce a new working version of the prototype that doesn't break. How does it do that? And the tools that I've seen out there, everybody is telling me, yeah, I can. If I do a little mock project, it's very cool. But if I try to use this in a production environment and produce something of the same quality I used to be producing, that last mile of getting the details right, as somebody put it the other day, you can get Midjourney to create you a cute picture of a cat, but how do you get it to make the cat just a little bit cuter? It's almost impossible to do in the prompt world. And this, how do we use this in a real customer production environment, particularly in, you know, things like I've got clients who work on molecular modeling tools. So how do you prototype X-ray diffraction for a protein scientist? And this is not the sweet spot for this. And I think that the real work is not going to be these toy little, you know, put together a quick shopping app that no one actually will ever shop on. This is something very different.
I think there's kind of two parts to that. One is certainly nothing that I've seen is production ready in the sense of I'm going to push this onto a live website. I mean, there are some exceptions, but generally speaking, I would agree with that. With things like what you're going to use for user testing and how you're going to use it, you know, do you use a prompt-based UI creator when you want to iterate on user testing? No, you don't. It's like anything. I mean, it's about using the right tool for the job. I grew up in a time when
we did usability testing with paper mockups, and
yeah,
And you could bring people into a room and simulate the entire product you were building using little strips of paper that you would put down and pretend to be the computer. And it worked. So usability testing doesn't need a lot. But it's really hard to create paper mock-ups of, you know, let's say a platform that traders use for bond options. And that's, you know, at what point does the rubber hit the road? That's the question I have. And I think that we actually, everybody is taking where we were 3 years ago and plotting a straight line through a point that's where we are today and saying, oh my gosh, in the future, look at where we're going to go.
Oh yeah.
I think all the easy problems have been solved in AI. And I think that what we're going to see for the next decade, at least, is an incredible slowdown of new capabilities. I think that's part of the reason why everybody is so unimpressed with Figma and what the keynote had in it, because they couldn't actually continue the line from last year.
I don't think we're going to see the replacement of anybody, if I'm honest, through this, within our industry. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think that there is value. Like anything, you need to use the right tool for the right job at the right time.
Sure.
And, you know, if you're trying to iterate between sessions with, you know, in a usability testing, then of course you're not going to use AI for that. On the other hand, if you want to, I mean, I've got a great example. I wanted to do a top task analysis with the World Book Day I'm working with at the moment. And I had a look around, and I've always been very dissatisfied with any survey app. It doesn't recreate it doesn't work well for a top task analysis. And so I was able to sit down and get AI to write me a little survey app that worked perfectly for top task analysis within, you know, a few hours. And I could actually use that in that scenario. But would I use AI to create every app that I needed? Of course not. You know, you've got to kind of pick and choose the right tool for the right situation. What I am interested in, one thing that Mr. Nielsen said that did grab my attention, and I'm interested in your thoughts about this, and this is looking a lot further ahead now. He's, to be fair to him, he's talking a decade plus away, which Marcus doesn't care about because he's going to retire by then. But he talked about why he wondered whether we will get to a situation where no one is actually visiting, certainly informational websites anymore, but literally it's AI agents that are going and looking at these websites and just pulling back the information. Because, and he made quite an interesting case for this, which is that, you know, you're not having to learn a new interface every time you go to a website. You know, it's providing you the information within your personalized context. It can meet your accessibility needs and that kind of stuff. So I'm interested in what you think, whether we will get to a world where actually, for not SaaS applications, I think that's a different conversation, but for informational websites, whether you can imagine a world where these might go away and we might just be asking an AI.
As with anything, I think there's an it depends element to it, right?
Yeah.
I think the nature of the information, the context of the information, how do the business models work in this environment? You know, do we actually have the ability to make the standards? I mean, this was the promise of fucking microformats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, all we're doing is reinventing things we've already come up with, but we're labeling them with AI or as our Secretary of Education calls it A1. She went on a couple of weeks ago about how amazing it's going to be that kindergartners and first graders are going to have access to A1. This promise has been around forever, and Jacob has been selling this idea and micro formats and micro payments for 20 years. This is not a new idea. And sure, that happens today. I Google broccoli pasta because I'm in the mood for pasta. I need a vegetable and I have broccoli. And I get recipes. But I have to go to recipe sites because that's how they make money. They don't want an agent. Now, if the agent's going to transact for me and pay for me, that's fine. But if we still have an advertising-based world, which I think we will, because I don't see how advertisers are going to say, well, AI is here. I guess we're done. No more advertising. I don't see how anybody is happy that they don't get to have ad revenue. And what does that look like in this world? Does the agent force me to watch an ad before I get my content? Right? I just think this is... all of this science fiction shit is lovely. Though I do want to point out that the main reason people write science fiction is as a warning, not a manual. The fact is that of course we can imagine a world where, all of this works smoothly until we get to the realities of how does anybody make money at this?
I totally agree with you over that one. I think there's a lot of kind of guesswork about what possible future might happen. And when you've been in the industry,
I'm leaning towards all years. The dystopian ones myself, because that, I mean, that seems to be much easier to bank on.
Well, you're cheerful then.
Our Department of Homeland Security Secretary just came out that she wants to run, and this is in the headlines today as we're recording this, it's the top headlines. She wants to have a television reality show where immigrants compete for getting access to citizenship, and the ones that lose get deported. And
I think wasn't that a film called Running Man back in the 80s? I think
Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, there are so many dystopian novels based on this trope.
We'll be having beheadings, next to the castle in the middle of the city soon, and people will be able to come and watch.
We'll have motorcycle events that involve spikes and flamethrowers. Gladiator again. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's that's the direction I think is reliably predictable.
All right, if we're talking about dystopian futures, then what about everything you read on LinkedIn at the moment about the state of the UX job market and all the doom and gloom that there's no UX jobs anymore and everybody's now calling themselves product designers? What's your thoughts on all of that, Jared? Because I know that you have opinions on this subject.
So, I mean, let's take this apart, right? First, the job title thing is, I don't think is particularly important. Whatever job they want to call us, if they pay us well, let's just do it. So, If they want to call us UX UI service designers, then let's be UX UI service designers. Who cares? Right. So that's the first thing. So I don't think it matters what the job title is, because I don't, you know, look, when, so for reasons that I don't need to get into, I have spent a lot of time with doctors and hospitals lately. I have met all these people who have all these different titles. There's like 30 different types of cardiologists in the world, I've come to learn. And they all are very particular about which flavor of cardiology they do and how they do it. And somehow having those distinctions makes it easier for them to talk amongst each other. But every patient I met refers to them as doctor.
Yeah.
And yeah. It doesn't matter. And the patients don't need to know that nuance and subtlety that goes into which doctor do you talk to at which time about which thing. And so, you know, I've been working with an anticoagulant clinic, and the anticoagulant clinic just focuses on anticoagulants and the treatment of and the use of anticoagulants. And it's a very specialized part of cardiology. And the people in there have deep knowledge and deep understanding. And if somebody says, I work in anticoagulants, it is very clear to everybody else in the medical profession what they do. But the rest of the world doesn't give a shit. So the title thing is not important, except for, you know, help us shortcut conversations. If I say I'm a product designer, does that mean something different than if I say I'm a visual designer, or I'm an interaction designer, or I'm a UX UI designer, or I'm a service designer? What does it really mean? And, you know, does it get to the point where you say, don't call Marcus because that's not the designer you need, call Paul? And you have to understand nuance to be able to have that level of conversation. And frankly, our clients and our stakeholders and our employers, they don't understand that level of nuance. So that's not the thing. The reason that there's a bunch of reasons why things feel really difficult right now. And one is that the industry, the job market. So but we have to separate out the UX profession from the UX job market. The UX profession is stronger than it's ever been. I estimate, and I have a bunch of different ways that I do the estimation, so I have a range to work with, but depending on how you want to count things, I'm estimating that there's somewhere between 2 million and 4 million UX people in the world, okay? And that might be conservative. There might be as many as 5 to 7. A million UX people. I remember, because I am fucking old, I remember when all the UX people on the planet could fit inside a single hotel ballroom. And I remember this because we did it. We got them all in one ballroom. And we had a lovely meeting in 1983. And I remember that. And the thing is that this just blows me away. The idea that there could be 4 or 5 million of us on the planet at once who are doing amazing work is just incredible. And I meet UX people all over the world, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Pakistan, and I talk to them all the time, and it's the work they're doing is top grade work. So this is to me incredible. There are more open UX jobs on the market right now than there has been in any time in history, including during the boom of 2021, 2022, where we saw a real spike in the number of jobs. We are now exceeding that number of jobs. So that's great news. The problem that we have is there are more unemployed UX people than we've ever had before. Let's say we take the conservative number of there's 2 million UX people in the world. If at any given time, 10% of them are thinking about changing jobs, 1 out of 10 is thinking about trying something new, which would not think about the people you work with. That's probably a reasonable percentage. If we have 2 million people, that means we have 200,000 people looking for jobs. We do not have 200,000 open jobs on the market right now. That's the problem we have. And so people apply to every job, and so you get hundreds of applications for every job, and then, you know, the hiring managers are completely flooded by all these applications. Most of them are not really qualified because our hiring systems suck, and as a result, understanding what you have to say and do to make sure you only apply to jobs that you are absolutely qualified to do is really hard. And so people just apply to everything. I hear about people who have applied to hundreds of jobs over the last few months and they didn't get a single interview because they didn't actually qualify for those hundreds of jobs, but they applied to them anyways, and they're disappointed. And so everything is in this world now where we have way too many people looking for jobs and way too few jobs for them to look at, even though we have more jobs on the market than we've ever had. And that's the core problem. And there's a bunch of reasons as to how we've gotten to this state, but that's why the job market sucks.
So, I mean, like you say, there's lots of reasons why we've ended up in this state, and there's you know, it's easy to blame one particular area.
Well, I can tell you what it's not,
or whatever.
I can tell you the ones that are popular, but it's not AI replacing people, because as you've said, that's not happening. Right? It's not that companies are executives are somehow thinking that UX is no longer valuable. There's no evidence of that. We have more UX people employed than we've ever had, and companies are doing this. There is evidence that certain companies really oversaturated because they did a lot of speculative hiring during the pandemic, because we were going to get a metaverse and Web3 and cryptocurrencies and all this other shit that never happened. And as a result, those organizations ended up hiring speculatively. And then when it turns out nobody actually wants a metaverse, they laid everybody off. And so there's a lot of people on the market who were victims of that layoff mentality. And then once the floodgates opened, a lot of people just sort of cleaned out what they perceived as low performing deadwood, whether it's true or not. And that's there. But that turns out that 90% of the layoffs come from a very small number of companies, and that most people have not been laid off, or not, you know, most companies are not doing that. They're just not hiring hundreds of UX people. They're only hiring 3 or 4 or 2 or 1. And, you know, 1 million people being hired one at a time is a painful process. And so that's part of it. This situation, what a big part of it was, we had a lot of boot camps that saw the boom in the pandemic, charged people a lot of money to change careers, and now you have a lot of inexperienced, unqualified or less qualified boot camp graduates that are struggling because companies aren't hiring junior people. Because when you can get a senior person for almost the same price, why would you hire a junior person?
So what do you do? What do you do if you are one of that group of people that is currently out of a job?
The junior folks or the more senior folks?
Both, really. Because, I mean, you know, if you're one of those people that are out of a job, the fact that you're turning around and saying, oh, well, the industry's booming, it's the best time ever, it doesn't feel like that if you're the poor sap that hasn't got a job at the moment. In fact, that makes you feel shit.
That's absolutely true. For the more experienced people, what you need to do, and it's because you have the experience, is you have to be pickier about the jobs that you apply to.
Yeah.
And you have to really tailor your the message of your application to the job, right? You can think of the job ad as an interview that has been started. You go through every bullet of the job ad, and if the job ad says, in this job, you will work with a multidisciplinary team to create innovative customer solutions, you take that as a question. And you have to make sure your materials explain how you've worked in the past on cross-disciplinary teams and how you've delivered innovative customer solutions, right? You have to answer that question. And the best way to do that is to literally answer the question. Here in my resume is exactly where I tell you that I've worked on cross-disciplinary teams. Here in my case study is the case study of how we produced an innovative customer solution. And you talk specifically to that. People who are tailoring their materials specifically to the job ads are getting interviews and getting offers. The people who have one resume and one portfolio and they send it everywhere and it doesn't actually say anything that's in the job ad doesn't get through the screening software. So that's how you do that. For the folks who are new in the industry, the only advice I have right now is figure out a way to get experience. Right. If that means, and I saw someone do this, they started volunteering at their local rescue dog shelter. And then they, while they were helping walk dogs, they also volunteered to redo parts of the website for the shelter. And they were able to use that as their experience because they're doing production work for real people doing real things, not toy apps, but real production level things that get a result, like get dogs adopted. How did you change the rescue website such that it more dogs were getting adopted? That's the type of experience that hiring managers are looking for. And there are positions available for people with less experience. There are just not positions available for people with no experience.
And I think there's a big difference as well. You know, what you're saying about working on a real project with real clients, with real stakeholders, with real internal politics, all of those kinds of things, because that's what, as an employer, you want to know. You want to know that this person is able to interact in a real environment. I totally agree with that. Very much so. Okay, I think that's a good place to end, because that's a nice kind of solid advice to wrap up on, where, you know, because
a positive finish.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than AI future, we don't care anyway, we're retiring, which wasn't such a positive.
Get off my porch.
Yeah, exactly. So, Marcus, do you have a joke to wrap us up with?
Just a quick one, yeah. This is from Paul Edwards, who's donated many jokes over the years. I went to a zoo and saw a baguette in a cage. Apparently, it was bred in captivity.
Really? I like that one.
When is retirement, Marcus? Can you
remind me? Soon. No, not soon enough, clearly.
No.
Apparently.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Jared. Thank you, Marcus, for joining us today. A really interesting conversation. I hope it's helped people realize that it's not as doom and gloom out there as everybody thinks, whether we're talking about AI or the job market. There's a lot of exciting stuff. You're not going to be out of a job. There is a future ahead of us. And I'm really excited at the moment about the state of UX. There's lots of new fun things to challenge us, but there's interesting work out there. So, yeah, it's a good time. So thanks for listening, and we will speak to you again next time.